You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I want to recognize first the director of the public health program, Françoise Girard, who's here sitting in the second row. Thanks to her for sponsoring this. The president of OSI, Arye Nair, is with us this evening and will be a discussant and offer some remarks after Helen Epstein's presentation and perhaps pose the first question or two. A number of people in the public health program put a lot of work into this event, Olga Baralia, Paula Dellis, and of course the facilities and events staff at OSI were very helpful as well. So thank you all for coming, and thanks to them, and thanks to you. For those of you who have been reading and enjoying Helen Epstein's work in the New York Review of Books, in the New York Times Magazine, and other publications over the past several years, her book, The Invisible Cure, was a much anticipated literary event, and I don't think that the book disappoints at all. Following a number of articles with such provocative titles as Can AIDS Be Stopped? And AIDS in South Africa, The Invisible Cure, Helen has finally put together her best thinking on AIDS in Africa into a book that challenges not only the multilateral institutions that were set up to fight AIDS in Africa, but all of us who participate in some way in that epic fight. For those of you who don't know, Helen has a background as a laboratory scientist and a microbiologist who first set out to find that magic bullet, the AIDS vaccine, and very soon afterwards left that world of test tubes and pipettes for the world of investigative journalism. And her background as a laboratory scientist and as a journalist are both, I think, very much in evidence in her book, which combines the best of hard-nosed investigative journalism and scientific acumen, as well as, I think, fundamental humanity about what AIDS involves and what is required to stop it. In 2005, I personally had the great privilege of doing an investigation with Helen for Human Rights Watch on the plight of children affected by HIV in three African countries. And we traveled to Kenya and Uganda and South Africa together to interview children about their reduced opportunities for schooling and education as a result of having been orphaned or otherwise affected by HIV. And all of the three qualities of Helen's that I just mentioned were so much in evidence during that investigation. Her scientific skill, in the way that she had collected reams of peer-reviewed articles and data statistically showing the reduced educational opportunities for AIDS-affected children. Her journalistic eye, in which she asked probing questions of everyone we met, and I don't think believed a single word that anybody told her during that trip. And of course, her humanity, in which she recognized, as she tells and retells in this book, the way in which the most profound solutions and indeed the invisible solutions to AIDS in Africa lie in the common sense and the ingenuity of Africans themselves. And the fact that the global response to HIV has stagnated so much is largely due to our failure to listen to those solutions. So we will begin tonight's program with Helen wowing you with a number of her most interesting and provocative findings on AIDS in Africa, after which Arye Nair will provide some commentary on her talk and begin with the first couple of questions. And then we have two standing microphones dispersed throughout the room where you can then line up for questions. But before we begin, I want to advise you that the Open Society Institute may be recording this event, and that your presence and participation for possible, as well as your presence and participation for possible subsequent distribution, and that your continued presence following this notice constitutes your legal permission to OSI to do so, as stated on the placard posted at this podium and or on the walls of this room. So with that rousing conclusion to my opening remarks, it's my honor to introduce you to Helen Epstein. Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan, for that very generous introduction. Can everyone hear me? Yeah? Okay, good. If you can't, let me know at any point. Great. So I'm going to try to condense this book into about 30 minutes, which will so I better get going with it. Oops, that's the wrong thing. So I'm going to talk about this region of Africa here. Which is the east and southern region of the continent, this rim, which is home to roughly 3% of the world's population, but about half of all cases of HIV infection occur here. I'm going to discuss both the likely reasons for this and some thoughts about what might be done about it. Some of the proposals that I make might seem sort of obvious, but one thing you might want to bear in mind is why they haven't really been emphasized in the past. When the AIDS epidemic first emerged in the early 1980s, it seemed to be largely confined to certain risk groups, meaning mostly gay men, IV drug users, and commercial sex workers and their sexual partners. And this is still the case in most of the rest of the world, but it is not the case in this part of Africa. Here, everyone is at risk, from subsistence farmers to cabinet ministers. To illustrate this, Mark Shields of USAID estimated who had HIV in Zambia, a very high prevalence country in this region, in 2002. This pie chart shows the fraction of cases that are transmitted to and from the little wedge there, I guess, this section of the pie, shows the fraction of HIV cases that are estimated to be transmitted to and from typical high-risk groups, sex workers and their typical partners, truck drivers and so on, migrant workers, soldiers and so on, and onward to their wives. And but according to him, based on his findings, more than 90% of HIV positive people in Zambia belong to no typical high risk group. There's also a considerable amount of evidence that what's going on in this part of Africa is not typical promiscuity in the usual sense of the word. There's much more evidence than this, but here's one particularly illustrative example. These are three studies that were conducted in the early 1990s in Uganda, Thailand, and the U.S. when the HIV rate was 18%, 2%, and 1% respectively in these countries. And people were asked, among other things, have you had 10 or more lifetime sexual partners? And the answers are shown here. And as you can see, the winners are Thai men, who 65% of whom had had 10 or more partners in their lives. And yet, the HIV rate there is relatively low. It's bad, but it's nothing like on the scale of, it's an order of magnitude less than in Uganda. And that's probably because there's more than half of the men in this particular survey said that they visited sex workers on a fairly regular basis, about five times a year. They would go out with their pals and have a sort of blowout. But that tends not to be, that kind of thing is rather less common in Africa. Here, for example, are the results of two studies conducted quite independently, one of them in Carletonville, a mining town, gold mining area in South Africa in 1998, and another one in Maseru, Lesotho in 2002, which is a country that, this is the capital of a country that sends a lot of men to the mining areas of South Africa. And these are the men, these are countries with very, very high, again, HIV rates in the 20s, 30s, et cetera, 40s even. And the fraction of men, even high-risk men, you'd think, minors, soldiers, and so on, who say they visited a sex worker in the last year, was relatively low. And if we go back here, even American men and women are more likely to say they've had 10 or more sexual partners than the Ugandans were. And this is not the only example of this. There was a review in The Lancet not that long ago suggesting that on average African men and women have fewer lifetime sexual partners than people in Western countries do. And that's based on a very large number of studies. So what is going on? Well, what I and a number of others think is that it's not that Africans have so many sexual partners, but that they are more likely than people in other world regions to have more than one, perhaps two or three long-term partners at a time. So a man may have two wives or a wife and a girlfriend, and the girlfriend or maybe one of the wives may have another partner on the side and so on, and that partner will have another partner. And as I'll explain in a minute, this creates a type of sexual network that's highly conducive to the rapid spread of HIV, even when the absolute number of partners is low. But first, just quickly, some evidence that that's likely to be the case. Oops. This is a slide redrawn from a paper that was published in a book in 1995, and it's based on some sexual behavior surveys conducted around the world in the late 80s and early 90s. And among the many questions on the surveys was, do you, in addition to your long-term, your spouse or long-term partner, have another partnership that's lasted more than a year? And as you can see in these sites, Rio de Janeiro, and then these sort of Asian sites here, Singapore, Sri Lanka, et cetera, relatively few people say this, whereas in these African countries, both men in blue and or gray or whatever that is, and pink or blue, red here, say that they do. This fraction is quite high. As many as half of men in Lesotho say that they have more than one long-term partner. And this, in fact, if you go through this chapter, which is a compilation of all the answers to the different sexual behavior questions, this is the only thing that really stands out. Age of sexual debut in Africa is relatively the same as it is everywhere else in the world. Numbers of lifetime partners, as we've seen, isn't that different. There's nothing else that's particularly striking except this one graph, at least that I could find, and so it's quite interesting. This system is kind of like polygamy. Formal polygamy is dying out, but there's a lot of informal polygamy still, and there's a whole slang vocabulary for it right across the continent. In Zimbabwe, men refer to their small house. In Francophone countries, it's the deuxième bureau. In South Africa, people refer to their roll-ons because you keep your secret lovers hidden under your arms. The relationships are generally long-term and very different from the impersonal one-off encounter you have with a prostitute, but there's often a transactional element to them. The exchange of gifts is common and expected. And so girls in South Africa will talk about how they have a minister of finance, a minister of housing, a minister of transport, and so on. Long-term concurrency, as this type of behavior is known, long-term concurrent behavior relationships occur everywhere, but they're less common outside of Africa, especially among women. For example, in the West, the prevailing pattern is one of serial monogamy, where people have one long-term partner at a time with whom they remain faithful for months or years or perhaps even decades. But then they break up and move on to someone else. And you can rack up a lot of partners that way, but it's actually a system that's a lot safer when it comes to HIV transmission, as the following little movie illustrates. This is prepared by Stuart Parkinson of Population Services International, and I think it illustrates this really nicely. If you look at a typical network of concurrent sexual partnerships here, where we have men in squares, women in circles, and as you can see, all these people are sort of linked up by these various relationships. No one's having tons of partners here. All these relationships are stable and long-term. They're not going to change. This guy has four partners. I think there's a woman somewhere with three partners. But most people, here's another one, but most people have only one or two partners. And but look what happens when we introduce HIV into this network. Bang. It spreads extremely quickly to everyone because these people are having sort of ongoing relationships. And, you know, by the very rapidly. Within months, everyone's infected. If we have a serial monogamy situation, say more typical of the West, we can have, as you can see what happens, we introduce HIV here, and even though there's all this bed hopping going on in the background, the HIV isn't getting really much of a grip until these people who, one guy gets infected, and then he has to switch partners and won't pass the virus on until then. In 1997, Martina Morris of the University of Washington showed that all other things being equal, if you have the same number of people with the same number of partnerships, but different sexual arrangements where one group is practicing predominantly serial monogamy and the other is practicing long-term concurrency, you can get a much faster epidemic, much faster spread of the virus in the concurrency group, and the resulting epidemic is actually 10 times greater after 5 years. And the average number of partnerships per person you need to get a full-blown epidemic with long-term concurrency when it's common is less than 2, so this is a very powerful effect. One thing that Martina Morris did not include in her model was the effect of viral load, which probably makes this even more dangerous than she thought it was. It turns out that every sexual act between somebody who's positive and negative doesn't necessarily result in transmission. There's a probability involved, and that probability is related to the concentration of virus in a person's blood. So early on, right after a person becomes infected, his viral load, the fraction of virus in his blood, rises very high, and the transmission likelihood is some people think it's even like 1 in 2 or something, even higher than it says here, 1 in 25. But then what happens is the immune system kicks in after a few weeks and knocks the concentration of the virus down. It stays low for years and rises again only as the person begins to get sick many years later. So during this time, it's thought that HIV transmission is relatively unlikely, but early on it's very high, and this makes long-term concurrency even more dangerous than Martina Morris thought it was, because this means that a recently infected man will infect all his long-term partners very quickly, and they'll infect their partners, whereas if our serial monogamist gets infected, he may infect his one long-term partner, but neither of them will infect anybody else until they break up, say 6 months, a year, 10 years later, at which point their viral load is low. Just quickly an aside about the Middle East, where long-term concurrency is also common. HIV rates are very low there, probably because of male circumcision, which is nearly universal in those countries, and we now know sharply cuts the risk of transmission. And also because while men may have multiple partners, women's sexual behavior is under stronger social kind of surveillance, and so if a man gets infected, he may infect his wives, but the virus is unlikely to spread on from there, relatively speaking. The implications of the male circumcision finding seem obvious. We need to make sure that a safe, affordable, non-coercive male circumcision services are available to all men who want them, but even where male circumcision is nearly universal, HIV rates can still be quite high, about 5% or so. So behavior change remains our best weapon for now, but how to do it? We've been trying to tell people to change their behavior for 20 years now, and the message seems to be falling on deaf ears. So what do you do? One thing to do is look at Stuart's picture again, this concurrency diagram. What are the implications of this? To me, it says three things. One of them is that these are long-term relationships that are based on affinity and trust, and it's going to be very hard to get people to use condoms consistently. As Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni said to everyone's dismay at the AIDS conference in Bangkok, Thailand, 3 years ago, you can't condomize the whole world. And he was right. He got a lot of people's backs up, but he was correct. Condoms are important, but people use them mainly with sex workers and in casual relationships. Consistent condom use is very hard to sustain in a long-term relationship. There was actually an article in a Ugandan newspaper not that long ago about this one couple in the whole country that had used condoms throughout their 14-year relationship. This was national news. And I think this is why condom promotion hasn't had as much as effect as expected on the epidemic in East and Southern Africa. It's not that the condoms don't work, but that they're not being used. And the relationships in which the virus is most likely to be spreading. So the second thing this drawing says to me is that a lot of people at risk are faithful already, as we know, these women in particular and this man, several men. And even those who aren't faithful to one are faithful to two or three, and these are people they trust and so on. And they're based on powerful social and economic and emotional ties, which can be very hard to break. So telling everyone to abstain and be faithful has its limitations also. So what do you do? Well, one thing you can do is look at what happened in places where the epidemic did turn around, and I'm going to quickly discuss two places where that happened. First, gays in the 1980s in the U.S., and Ugandans a couple of years later in the late 1980s, early 90s. In both places, there was a massive collective shift in sexual norms, which was brought about by a remarkable degree of activism, openness, talking, caring for the sick and otherwise infected. It was like everyone moved together. It wasn't an individual thing. It was like the ice melted, if this were an ice cube, for example. And I really think it had to be that way because sex is complicated. It involves more than one person. So for behavior to change, people have to get together and talk about it and figure out what to do. And that's why social mobilization is so important for HIV prevention. But that's also why HIV prevention is so difficult. Public health doesn't even have a name for this, let alone a recipe for programming it. There are ways to screw it up, though, which I talk about in the book mainly, and refer you to that. But first to the gay men. Almost as soon as the first news bulletins about a new disease affecting gays came out in 1981, a huge social movement got underway. Gay men and their friends really came together and they talked to each other, they took care of each other, they argued about bathhouses and condoms and modes of transmission. If you go into the AIDS section of any library in the U.S., you'll find a wall of literature that came out around the epidemic at that time, plays, memoirs, poems, and so on. It was like a mass conversation, and a lot of you will remember it and also participated in it. During this period, the incidence of the virus fell by some 80%. This was partly attributable to condom use, but partner reduction was at least as important, if not more so. And this is illustrated, this is just one example, of which shows the fraction of men, gay men in in a study in San Francisco reporting multiple anal sex partners per six-month period between 1984 and 1987. You can see there was a steep decline. There are also modeling studies suggesting that the behavior change was underway as early as 1981, so the drop was probably even more dramatic than this. But the most important thing wasn't what the men did, but that they knew where their risks were coming from, and they took obvious steps to protect themselves and their friends. They increasingly avoided bathhouses, stuck to as few partners as they could, used condoms consistently otherwise. They took pretty obvious steps. They knew what to do. Same sort of thing, I think, happened in Uganda. As you can see here, there was a decline here. This just shows the decline in HIV infection rates in pregnant teenagers. Teenage pregnancy rates are incredibly high in Uganda. It's like by age 19, some 70% of young women have had a kid, or at least at this time that was the case. As you can see, the HIV rate among these pregnant teenagers plummeted during the 1990s by about 70%. And it fell in older groups as well, though not as dramatically. But this happened throughout the country, by the way, not just in the South, but in the North and also in the West. So these teenage pregnancy rates did not change until quite late in the decade. So between 95 and during the early 90s, there wasn't much change in the teenage pregnancy rates. It wasn't as though the girls weren't having sex. And it certainly wasn't that they were using condoms more effectively, but it's likely that either they or their partners were having were more faithful to each other than they had been in the past. There's been some controversy about whether the Uganda decline was due to condom use or abstinence or partner reduction. Unfortunately, some of that controversy has actually been manufactured. The evidence that it was actually partner reduction in this case was very strong. Let's see. Okay. So what have we got next? Ah, okay. So this decline, which was happening, as you can see, this is antenatal clinic rates, HIV rates in pregnant women across different cities in Africa during the 1980s and 90s. And as you can see, the HIV rate declined in Kampala, but in virtually nowhere else. This is Malawi, Botswana, South Africa, et cetera. It seemed to be sort of soaring across the continent. So why didn't this happen elsewhere? I don't know. It's a hard question to answer. But I was in Uganda in the early 1990s, and I remember, and I actually arrived here in 1993, just with the beginning of this decline, and nobody really knew what was going on at that time. Everyone still thought the HIV rate was declining. It was soaring in Uganda, too. So it was sort of hard to say, but what I remember from that time is that everyone was talking about AIDS in highly personal ways. The epidemic might have been very different from the gay epidemic, but the response was remarkably similar. There were plays and vigils and marches and private conversations. There was vigorous public debate about condoms, about how men and women treated each other. And there was a lot of caring for orphans and the sick. And some of these care programs were supported by donors and churches, but some weren't programs at all. They were just people coming together to help each other, to talk, and so on. In the book, I quote a man who remembers that time saying, "You go over and take care of the kids, sweep the floor, just sit and talk to the patient. You couldn't just do nothing." All this was accompanied by a vibrant women's movement, which Uganda already had for historical reasons, and AIDS fit right into their agenda. Women got together and challenged men's behavior and talked about their own behavior, and it was very much an African brand of feminism, by the way. There was even a Ugandan association of co-wives and concubines that policed the behavior of polygamous men to ensure that they didn't endanger the rest of their family. We'll never know why people in other African countries didn't respond to AIDS in this way. But for a while I've wondered whether it might have something to do with the fact that, like gay men, Ugandans knew where their risks were coming from, and this made it possible to talk more openly about AIDS and respond pragmatically. They didn't know the word concurrency, but they did know that the virus was spreading through ordinary families. It wasn't just a high-risk group thing. Martina Morris, who did the modeling studies on concurrency that I talked about earlier, actually got her ideas from Ugandans. She'd gone there in 1993 to do a survey and of sexual behavior. And at the time, she, like most people, assumed that the virus was spreading through typical high-risk behavior, prostitutes, truck drivers, etc. And she wanted to find out who these people were and how many partners they had and so on. And then she'd plug everything into her computer program and predict the spread of the virus in the future. Anyway, she was presenting this plan to a group of Ugandan doctors, and in the middle of her lecture, one of them raised his hand and asked, "Can your model handle situations where people have more than one sexual partner at a time?" She said, "No, the mathematics is too difficult. I can't do that." The man then walked out of the room. Martina was chagrined because there was much talk in the country at the time about, which has a relatively sophisticated medical community, about helicopter scientists, whites, who came into the country and took data and scooped it out and then didn't consult with local African researchers and doctors and so on. So anyway, she finished her lecture. But afterwards, the other Ugandan doctors came up to her and told her that if she didn't include concurrent partnerships in her model, the whole exercise would be pointless. So she went back to the drawing board and made the model of concurrency and measured and did the survey measuring concurrency and modeling it that I described earlier. Anyway, in 1986, 7 years before Martina Morris's lecture, those same Ugandan health officials designed their own HIV prevention program long before donors came on the scene, and their campaign had two main messages. One of them was zero grazing, or love carefully, which is local slang, meaning basically, let's see if it's here, here it is, try to stick to one partner, but at least avoid casual partners, bar girls, and so on, and don't take on additional concurrent partners if you can avoid it. And here's one of the posters from that campaign. This is from 1991. You see, it's sort of local idioms. And the second message was everyone's at risk, not just truckers and sex workers and other so-called immoral, irresponsible people. So what happened was not universal monogamy, but it was a very sort of pragmatic tendency in that direction. And what was going on in the rest of Africa? Well, I've been acting as self-appointed monitor and evaluator of donor-funded AIDS programs for some years, and not everyone wants to thank me for doing this, but I can share you some of my impressions. One thing I've noticed is how many of these programs divide people and fail to bring them together, as I think needs to happen. And here's one example. Oops, this is just, if you want some data on behavior change, which I'll skip. This is a poster, an AIDS prevention poster from Botswana that was part of their campaign. It's promoting condoms, and it's a picture of a basketball, a condom, and the slogan, "Even the best ballers take a safe dunk with it." Ads like this were meant to help reticent African populations talk more openly about sex, but it's possible to see how it might send the opposite message, associating AIDS with unruly others who misbehave and have lots of casual sex. There's another one, which I don't have a copy of, but it's a picture, it's like this. It has a boxing glove and a condom, and the slogan, "It can take the fiercest punches." And this is in a country with rather high rates of domestic violence, a lot of very troubling gender problems. And I think it's possible to imagine how someone looking at such an ad might think, well, that's not me. I'm not a womanizer or a wife beater or a slut or something. And you have to remember that Africans, in many cases, hold rather strong moral views, just as everyone does. But their views on sexuality are particularly sensitive often because they've been shaped by centuries of blacks being told by whites that they're somehow lower down on the evolutionary ladder and more subject to the basic animal drives. So this kind of ad could really turn people off and send the wrong message and reinforce the incredible sense of shame and denial and stigma around AIDS that you see in Southern Africa. I describe in the book going on home-based care visits to in 2005, as late as that, with a group of... the group that was trying to recruit patients for a testing and treatment program. And we went to all these homesteads and sat with all these really sick people, and nobody, not once, would say the word AIDS. They all said they had ulcers and witchcraft and so on. And they all knew they had AIDS, and their relatives knew it. But the home-based care counselors told me, it was the association with promiscuity and immorality, and that's why they wouldn't talk about it. Anyway, if we go back to Uganda, in around 1992, the Zero Grazing campaign was gradually phased that way. I think there's one more of these posters. Here's another one from Botswana. I think this is from last year, and it was in the newspaper, this year even. And it says, I'm 14, and I'm going out with an older man who adds flavor to my life, and one thing I do is have protected sex using Lovers Plus condoms every time. And I don't know, I mean, I'm not a prude about these things, but this is a country with a 30% epidemic. I don't know if this is the message that you'd want your 14-year-old to have in such circumstances. In Uganda, this was the corresponding ad from the late 80s, early 90s, where, this was the message there, which was basically stay away from those sugar daddies, they're dangerous. And to me, that's a better message. Anyway, in around 1992, the Zero Grazing campaign in Uganda was gradually phased out and replaced with a program that emphasized condom social marketing similar to those in the rest of the region. It was also other things were going on, but there was a very powerful condom campaign. But as the 90s wore on, officials began to worry because although the HIV infection rate had fallen rapidly in the early 90s, by the end of the decade it had stopped falling. And instead of reviving the Zero Grazing campaign, the Ugandans, getting their cue from the conservative Christians in the U.S. and their newly elected representatives in Congress and the White House, went whole hog and decided to mount an abstinence campaign, which sent a very different message, which is here. Here's a poster from that campaign, I think from about 2004, which is again here supported by USAID, which says, she's keeping herself for marriage, how about you? This campaign was accompanied by the emergence of a number of very flamboyant Christian pastors who advocated strict abstinence until marriage in their sermons and to youth groups and so on. And I met one of these guys once, and he was up in arms about another campaign that another organization was running, which I actually thought was pretty good. This one, I don't have a picture of either. Unfortunately, they sort of it's been erased from history, but it was really good. It was a picture of a choir girl, and the caption read, "Lucy's a beautiful girl. She's the best friend, and she always makes her parents proud. And she has HIV. Anyone can get AIDS. Everyone can prevent it." Anyway, this pastor hated this poster. He said, "Proud indeed. I'd like to meet that girl's parents. The only way to get AIDS is through promiscuity. We have to stamp it out." Anyway, he and the AIDS activists in Uganda had a huge battle in the press, and I had to take the activist's side because the abstinence message, like the condom ads, failed to convey the crucial point that in Africa, AIDS is everybody's problem, not just something caused by promiscuous others. So if I can leave you with two recommendations, one of them is that everyone needs to learn about concurrency and see Stuart Parkinson's little movie so that they'll recognize where their risks are really coming from, often from the people they know best. At the moment, a lot of people still don't understand this. Just in January this year, I was chatting to an official in the health ministry in an African country in this high prevalence region who was in charge of AIDS programs, and I explained to him the long-term concurrency hypothesis, and he had not heard of it before, but he understood it perfectly because he'd seen such relationships all around him. Now, if he didn't understand it, if he hadn't heard about it before, I think there are a lot of other people who haven't as well. The other recommendation is to support the kinds of community-based programs like those in Uganda that brought people together and addressed their real needs, like microfinance, orphan care, home-based care, women's rights, and so on, and do it seriously. As Jonathan and I discovered in South Africa, there are a lot of cynical people out there claiming to help widows and orphans and not really doing it. In conclusion, people always ask me, okay, so Uganda had a social movement, and that's what made their AIDS program work. How do you generate a social movement? And I say one thing that always galvanizes people is a common enemy. Too many programs have divided people, HIV positive from negative, moral from immoral, high risk from low risk, youth from elders, men from women, rich from poor. Such programs send the message that the enemy is people with AIDS. Ugandans and gay men knew early that the enemy was HIV itself.
While we're putting up the screen, we're just going to have a bit of a discussion up front here, and then after that, we'll ask people to line up at the two standing microphones. Thanks.
Okay. I think this is a superb book, and I am very grateful to Helen Epstein for pulling together her writing and thinking on this subject and publishing this book. Jonathan introduced Helen by saying that she brought to her work both the training she had as a scientist and also the skill of an investigative journalist. I would add to the qualifications that she brought to it, and that is, it seems to me that she also brought the approach of a human rights investigator. I differentiate a human rights investigator from an investigative journalist in the following way. The investigative journalist looks for the hot story and pursues an investigation for a particular period and then moves on to the next subject. The human rights investigator knows that you cannot make a difference in dealing with a severe problem by approaching it on a one-shot basis, that you have to stay with the subject over an extended period, and that it's only by dealing with it over a long period of time, that ultimately you are able to have some significant impact on the matters that you are concerned with. And I think focusing on this issue for a decade and a half has enabled her to learn a great deal about the subject. My guess is she will stay with it for some time to come, and that she will learn still more, and that we will have more to learn from her because she continues to focus on the subject. Obvious question, I think, is why did governments and intergovernmental bodies do so badly in dealing with the problem of AIDS? And that is, governments like the United States, influenced by the Christian right, or the government of South Africa, where President Mbeki and his health minister have pursued disastrous policies. And something of a revelation to me in reading the book, why did UNAIDS fail so badly in dealing with this issue? And I'm not sure of the answer to that question, but I think an obvious candidate is simply that sex is a difficult subject to talk about, and many government officials and government and intergovernmental agencies have difficulty when they come to sex. The fact that AIDS early on acquired such a stigma greatly exacerbated the difficulty, and meant that everybody applied their own ideological mindset to the problem, and didn't allow the information that was available to them to shape their policies. Rather, the policies came first, and they sought information which would confirm those policies. But perhaps there's more to it that I'm missing, but it does seem to me that there is a chronicle of failure here so far as governments and intergovernmental bodies are concerned. It does raise, for me, an important question, and that is, a foundation is also an institution with certain resources, and what should a foundation be doing that in fact is useful? In your recommendations, you talked about community-based programs, and yes, a foundation can be the source of support for community-based programs. That's a lot of what we do in dealing with issues worldwide. But I wonder if you've thought further about an institution that does have resources, and whether there are particular things that you think would be most valuable for an institution such as the Open Society Institute to engage in. I should also say that you stress the importance of another question that is important to us, which is local knowledge and local understanding of issues. And our approach has been to create foundations in different parts of the world and to rely on local knowledge to guide the actual activities that we engage in particular purposes. But local knowledge doesn't seem to have had so dramatic an effect in a number of different places. So that raises the question, how much can we, in fact, rely on local knowledge? I also was struck in the slide presentation when you showed the situation in various cities. One of the cities that you had in that slide was Dakar. And Dakar was a straight line with virtually no incidence of HIV. And so that raises the question why Dakar should have virtually no HIV. I don't know if that's still the case or...
It's not none, but it's very low.
Very low. Well, I mean, look, an obvious... you know, answer to that, but I don't know if, in fact, it's the full story, is that Senegal is a Muslim country. Men are all circumcised in Senegal. There are Muslims in some other places. There are Muslims in Abidjan, but it's not a predominantly Muslim city the way Dakar is. And so it does raise the question whether circumcision is even more dramatic than a factor than you suggest in reducing HIV. I became sort of fascinated by this by contrasting two countries. One was Angola and the other was Botswana. One would have thought Angola would have an extremely high level of HIV. This is a country that has been war-torn, tremendous amount of sexual violence in the context of the armed conflict, and a country with as distorted a distribution of resources as any that I can imagine. Enormous oil wealth and incredible poverty at the same time. Botswana is a peaceful country, a democratic country, a country where things work, yet Angola had a relatively low level of HIV, and Botswana has this extremely high level of HIV. And what I was told in Angola was not because they're Muslim, they're not, but by tribal custom, men are circumcised in Angola. Incidentally, Angola is the only country that I've encountered women as chiefs, including a paramount chief. Mm-hmm. The customs are quite different than in many other African countries. Botswana, apparently, by tribal custom, no men are circumcised. And so, you know, that made me think that maybe circumcision is, again, an even more dramatic factor in determining the prevalence of HIV than you suggest. So I'm interested in your comments on, you know, the Dakar phenomenon, the foundation role, and also this question of why did everybody do so badly in dealing with this problem?
Yeah, I'll answer those in no particular order, I think. First of all, in terms of Dakar, the other factor in much of West Africa that influences HIV infection rates fairly heavily is not just male circumcision, but also the degree of surveillance of female sexual behavior. So you can have men with multiple partners, but it's rather less common, I think, in a lot of those highly Muslim countries for women also to do so, so the network isn't linked up, and the HIV can't really spread on from the women so easily. And I think that's also a factor in Senegal. In some rural areas, you actually do have HIV rates as high as 4% in parts of Senegal, so I hear. And I think on that slide, Senegal is remarkable, but it's not that different from what's going on in the countries around it. As far as what's the best we can hope for with male circumcision, the randomized trials that have been done suggest that it reduces the transmission likelihood by about half or a little bit more, which is pretty amazing. What the problem is that we have to, circumcise a whole lot of people really fast, and that's not happening.
Does it also reduce the male susceptibility,
yes,
not just transmission?
That we don't know. It protects. That's the whole point. The men are less likely to get infected, so it takes away their
transmitting
to women. Yes, apparently it does reduce the likelihood that he will transmit. But although that's not as well defined yet or measured, but the other thing is that if you have to look at the extremes of what circumcision could achieve, go to Cameroon, which I think is universally circumcised but has an HIV rate, or at least Yaoundé did a while ago, of about 5%. So it's thought that
partially Muslim, partially Christian.
But it's universal. That the country is. But I think where they did this survey, it was what I hear from my circumcision mavens is that the best you could hope with universal circumcision is about 5%.
Mm-hmm.
You can still get an epidemic of about 5% with universal circumcision. And it's going to take a while to get to that point. So we need behavior change quick, as well as, hope for other things like microbicides and vaccines and so on. But in the meantime, we have to push on both fronts, I think. And as far as why are Angola and Botswana so different, one thing Angola had, which was lucky from the point of HIV, was a war, which actually tends to, it's now increasingly clear, and there have been studies on this, bad for a lot of reasons, but from the point of HIV, they tend to break up sexual networks, and you often see HIV rates soaring after a war is finished. So, for example, in Mozambique, HIV rates soared after the war ended in 1992. HIV rates fell in Congo between 1997 and 2003. People actually set out to study the spread of HIV in war in Congo, expecting it to rise after the beginning of the war, and it fell. And so it's a little bit paradoxical because, people are able to travel more and people have more disposable income in a place like Botswana, South Africa. So there's more transactional relationships, more moving around, and that tends to encourage the spread of HIV. So in addition to circumcision, and that's the other thing in Angola's favor, so-called, and Botswana's disadvantage. Why is sex so political? I don't know. I wish I knew the answer to that. I'd be a lot richer than I am. And but it is, I was once talking to Judith Bruce of the Population Council, and she was saying, essentially that's what that's what the clash of cultures is really about. I mean, it's really defines what cultures, how they define themselves in a lot of ways. I mean, it's really profound, and I don't know much about it, but it's definitely been a factor in the kind of confused response to this particular disease, whatever that is, and a tendency not to pay attention to the scientific evidence. I think it was really just confused people's minds in a lot of ways, the mixture of sex and politics. And in terms of what should foundations do besides try to find their way to help people at a local level while also paying attention to the best science that we have. I think, I can't say, but I just find your own way. I mean, it's terribly difficult to know what to do. But
what would you do if you had my job?
I do a lot of what you're doing, actually, to be honest. I do. I mean, I think, the traditional stuff in the places where you guys have traditionally worked in Central Asia, Eastern Europe, and so on, the kind of approach you've taken with particularly vulnerable groups is exactly the right approach for this kind of thing. I mean, harm reduction and so on. That's makes perfect sense. And in and it makes sense to a degree where there are such groups in East and Southern Africa too. But the kind of stuff that Jonathan is doing on kind of empowering people locally through access to legal services and so on is the kind of stuff that was going on in Uganda during this kind of crucial time. There were a lot of groups kind of doing that, campaigning around that, looking at the broader context in which people got infected and ordinary men and women lived. And so, you know, I encourage you to continue, I suppose.
I have a brief follow-up question on that issue. Just coming back, Helen, to the comment you made about social mobilization in Uganda and the way in which people talking to each other and the openness and the candor and the social networks and the close-knit communities were key to the response there. I mean, that would suggest a role for foundations like OSI, which are dedicated to promoting open civil society and freedom of association and freedom of expression. And a lot of the messages that were successful in Uganda were transmitted through radio and television. And I think that it's probably fair to say that the diversity of messages that were allowed was allowed then was probably richer than it is now, and that Uganda in some ways is undergoing a bit of a crackdown on civil society, although that could be debated. I mean, I have seen one study that attempted to correlate HIV rates to various indicators of civil society. Mm-hmm. And this was a study that in a very crude way, frankly, mm-hmm. tried to plot Freedom House rankings against HIV rates.
Then how does Botswana do so badly?
Exactly.
Right. Comes out so well. I mean, look, we were approached at one stage a number of years ago by the Gates Foundation and the Merck Corporation. And they said they had put $100 million between them into Botswana over, I think, a five-year period. Mm. $50 million from each source. And they basically felt that the effort was a failure. It was actually the Merck Corporation that said this to us, not the Gates Foundation. Mm. So what they asked for was, we don't think there is a civil society buy-in or a community buy-in to the program. Could you help with respect to a community buy-in?
Well, the two things I would do in Botswana. One thing is Botswana, surprisingly, with all due respect to any Botswana in the audience, is surprising. It's actually kind of a repressive country in some ways. It's very hard. People aren't as used to sort of speaking out as advertised, and I got the feeling there that from speaking to people that they were not quite as comfortable as speaking openly about problems and so on.
But people don't go to prison for doing
they
anything
do not
like
go
that.
To, no, no,
they don't get you know accidents happening to them because they speak out. Those things don't happen in Botswana.
But the culture of kind of openness is not as strong as it could be. But that's not the main problem. I think part of the problem, I think it's hard. There isn't that culture of activism, and how you generate that, I don't know, but you can often find it in these places. I did meet some extraordinary Botswana women running women's groups and legal groups and things like that, and they were, I mean, the thing to do is to find those people and encourage them as much as possible. I think that's one way you could start and create a few heroes and then see how they go. And the other thing is that I really, really do think that part of the problem why people in Botswana are so confused and silent about AIDS is the same reason really is in South Africa. It's just that they don't have as nutty a president, but they do have this confusion about where their risks are coming from. And if you got HIV, you must have been doing something bad. Mm-hmm. And if and that right. is a failure of us to explain and convey the science, which for whatever reason the Ugandan doctors understood, but others have not.
In that, I'd really like to follow up what Jonathan asked about in terms of Uganda, because my recollection, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but my recollection was that in the early 1990s in Uganda, the advertising that was done on radio and television and billboards and things like that was very explicit. I wondered if that had a role in taking some of the stigma away from the sexual activity and making it more possible to talk about the sexual activity than in many other countries where it wasn't the sort of cute advertising you showed there, but it was very subdued and didn't confront the problem explicitly. And I wonder how much of a role that played in Uganda.
It's tricky. I mean, there was a lot of in Mozambique, for example. They had the same company that was doing those basketball ads and stuff had a kind of a campaign of the winking condom man sort of slurping at people going by and stuff, and then other rather sort of lewd ads. And they actually turned a lot of people off because these are rather conservative cultures, even Uganda is. And I remember once a few years ago being, this was quite recently in 2000 or something, long after the zero grazing days, when I was waiting for someone in a hospice, which was also kind of a convent, and the radio was on, and someone was cleaning the floor, and on the radio there was like an hour-long program about how to use a female condom in the most very explicit, graphic, detailed, I guess, ways is what you'd say. And I was very sort of surprised by that, and everyone, you know, nuns were sort of swishing in and out, and it was very, everyone was, you know, completely unfazed by any of this. And I thought that was great. And there is a kind of unusual openness about sexuality in that culture. But it's not universal, and it's certainly not universal in that region. And I do think part of the conservatism regarding sexuality and the hung-upness that you see, you know, everywhere, but certainly in a lot of the high-prevalence countries in Africa is this one thing Uganda didn't have was a very heavy colonial presence. So in other words, there were relatively few, there were 600 white people in the whole country at the height of the colonial period there. It was really very loosely governed. The British did their bit to screw things up later on, but they didn't push people off their land, they didn't humiliate them, they didn't you know, they kind of categorized them as slightly a different species, but not in the same horrible way that Europeans did in South Africa, Zimbabwe, Kenya, and so on. So people don't have that same sense of kind of wounded dignity and shame, and a lot of the discourse around racial differences was around sexuality also, and I think that's really stuck with people, and I think it's what is messing with Thabo Mbeki's head in South Africa so to such a great degree, and Uganda to a larger extent, at least the southern part, was able to escape that discourse, I think, and felt therefore more open about it.
Helen, I have another Uganda story I want to run by you before we open this up to the audience, and this is actually Joya Mukherjee's story. She's the, for those who don't know, the medical director of Partners in Health, which is one of the leading groups that tries to deliver antiretrovirals in resource-constrained settings. And she tells this story about being in Uganda, again, I think in the early 90s, and talking to a group of school children and asking them one by one what they think is the main cause of AIDS in their country. And she said the first time she posed that question, a young Ugandan pupil raised her hand and said, poverty. And she tells this story, I think, as an example of, again, Ugandans' own very perceptive awareness of their own risks and the analysis that a young child could have. And yet, you know, bucking conventional wisdom, Botswana is another example of a fairly wealthy Southern African country with a prevalence upwards of 25% to 30%, so maybe poverty isn't as determinative as we might think. So what's your, I mean, you know, you've commented already on the fact that there's a transactional component to concurrent sexual relations, but you've also looked at the data much more closely than any of us. What's your reaction to that?
Well, one thing that Botswana has not only got a problem with denial often about HIV status, but also it's in denial about its own levels of inequality. I mean, they have, there are a lot of people there who are dependent on food baskets to survive. I mean, they have a welfare system, but they also, they never publish their poverty statistics, which is kind of worrying. And I know that when they last published them in the 1990s, something like 40% of the population was living below what they consider the poverty line there. And then they sort of, it's very hard to get that data, and I scrambled around trying to find it because I thought, hey, this is sort of odd. I mean, people there do talk about poverty a lot. And you know, and this causes lots and lots of problems. I mean, they recently had a terrible diarrhea epidemic there, and a lot of children died because they were, the Botswana Health Department was actually, I don't know if you saw this in the Washington Post, but was recommending HIV-positive women to to formula feed their kids because they thought, we're a middle-income country, we can afford to do this, everyone can boil milk and stuff. But they can't. They are not rich, and they're not nearly as rich as they think they are, or we'd like to think they are, they'd like to think they are. So there is, and I think, you know, what's more important than poverty itself, because in fact, if you look within African countries, it's often the very poorest people, the farmers and people out in the country who have no money at all, nothing. They have chickens and nothing, who are the most protected from HIV, and it's the relatively wealthy, the ones, the sort of the ones who do trading, who drive taxis and stuff, and who have a kind of a link to the global economy, and then gives them a little bit of money so they, you know, sort of can maintain, and often are socially obliged to maintain multiple partnerships and support poorer women. So it's inequality really that creates these sort of ravines that HIV spreads along, I think.
Okay, we have a good 45 minutes left, and there's a standing microphone here in the center aisle and one to my left. So if you could line up behind the microphone closest to you and please introduce yourself before asking a question, we will start here and we'll alternate back and forth.
Hi, I'm Wesley Clark. I work at Genuity Health Projects, which is a reproductive health research organization run by Beverly Winnikoff. You may have heard of her, even if you haven't ever heard of us. I wanted to get back to something that Dr. Nair was talking about that I didn't hear you address, because it touches on something that I am fondest of in your writing. And this may be a question that manages to be both inflammatory and irrelevant at the same time. I don't know. I hope it'll be more than that. But I used to work for WHO and briefly for UNFPA, and not on HIV. I should be very clear about that. And I love the fact that you're willing to say the emperor has no clothes a lot of times, because I feel like the amount of money that's spent on business class tickets and five-star hotels and also on insisting on log frames and deliverables and indicators that often have nothing to do with actually reducing the incidence of HIV, that all of that, I mean, at the very least, it diverts resources. And I guess I'm curious, do you think that the failure of large organizations to actually make enough of a dent in the epidemic is in any way, you know, can be traced to this misdirection of resources, or is that more just a question of, you know, it's wasteful but it's not damaging? I mean, I guess that's my question.
I think in some cases it can be corrupting. It doesn't have to be. I mean, sometimes it works. I think the ARV programs, the antiretroviral treatment programs, when people know what to do, I think that these agencies actually do a pretty good job. When they know that they want to get vaccines into arms or, you know, drugs into mouths or whatever it is, they can get their act together, and their approaches are absolutely right. The problem with HIV is that everyone was flummoxed. I mean, nobody knew what to do. They thought they knew what to do, as you said, and so they went and did, you know, confused, twirling around things. And I don't know. So I think that's part of the problem, and thought they were doing the right thing and reinforced each other, and it became a mess.
Can you tell us about slim AIDS and fat AIDS?
I guess so. Yeah, when I was in Uganda, even in the early days, when the big donors started to pour into Uganda in the early 90s, people began to, and including me, I mean, I was working on an AIDS vaccine project with a big fancy university and a biotech company. And Ugandans started talking about slim AIDS and fat AIDS. And with slim AIDS, you get thinner and thinner and thinner until you finally disappear. And with fat AIDS, which tends to afflict bureaucrats and big NGO honchos and doctors and stuff who fly around the world to conferences and stuff, you get fatter and fatter and fatter. being fat is a slang for greedy or thief, actually. I mean, that was what they thought we were. So, yeah.
Francois.
Hi, I'm Francois Girard. I'm the director of the public health program at OSI. Thanks for telling us that we're doing the right thing, but we'd invite you in even if you didn't. When I read the book, I kind of alternated between two conclusions. One, and I also felt that because I assume a lot of people are reading the book to find the next silver bullet, so they want to know what's the simple answer here? And they're going to come out after having read your book and said, oh, it's fidelity. That's it. That's what we have to tell the world. It's the B in ABC. And at the same time, there were some chapters, particularly the one about Tanzania, that's entitled The Invisible Cure, where you really were talking about something different, which was collective efficacy and communities through multiple programs addressing a range of issues, dealing with the problem, you know, using their own methods. So what is it?
Well,
what do you want us to take away from this?
Well, partner reduction is, I mean, what the real point is that what you do when you know where your risks are coming from is pretty obvious. It's what the gay men did. It's wherever HIV rates have fallen, people have reduced their partners. It's universal monogamy is an impossible goal everywhere, including here. But people can reduce their partners a lot. And gay men did. I mean, the fraction of people with multiple anal sex partners, as you can see, fell everywhere. And the same thing happened in Uganda. The same thing happened with very little condom use until the mid-1990s. It began to rise a bit. But by that time, the decline was well underway. And there wasn't even that much condom use until the late 90s, in fact. And Zimbabwe, likewise, you had soaring condom use rates during the 90s, but the HIV rate didn't start to fall until partner reduction began to occur since about 2000 or so. That's when you started to see this decline. And the same thing in Thailand. Everyone makes a lot of noise about the 100% condom program there, which was wonderful. People in brothels were encouraged to use condoms all the time, and that was enforced. But there was also a decline of 60% in visits to sex workers during the time that HIV rates were falling. So, you know, what would you do in those? I mean, it's common sense in a way. And it's particularly difficult to affect, you know, total monogamy, especially in a culture which is kind of based on these, where there's these traditions of long-term concurrency from a long time ago, but and they're part of the sort of pattern of everyday life, but it isn't impossible, even in a country where you know, women's rights are not exactly always respected, as is the case in Zimbabwe and Uganda. And it's not a perfect solution. It's not the answer. But I have this argument all the time with friends of mine is you know, who say, what's the difference? Why do you have to tell people about concurrency? Why can't you just tell them be faithful, just have one partner? To me, that will never, that's not going to get you anywhere. People need to understand the network. They need to understand that diagram that Stuart Parkinson drew, because they think all the people in that diagram think they are being faithful now. Many of them are. In fact, most of them are. And if they're not faithful to one, they're faithful to two or three. So faithfulness itself is not a good message. What they need to know is this thing is spreading from this family to that family to that family like that. And somehow, for whatever reason, the Ugandan doctors and researchers kind of understood that in the Ministry of Health very, very early on. And they said, this is the way we do things here, and this is what's causing this. That's what's going on. And they took very pragmatic steps to change it. So that's why I think this thing, actually, if you want to do something, go, and I've been trying to talk to people about this for ages at different agencies, for example, that work on HIV, is just go into schools and teach kids this. I don't understand why. If you go into the curricula of all of these life skills-based education programs in Africa, they tell you AIDS is transmitted through sex, wear a condom or abstain, or abstain, wear a condom maybe, that kind of thing. But there is absolutely nothing about this network. There's nothing about the particular dangers of long-term concurrency. So these kids come away with a message that if your aunt has got HIV or your mother has HIV, she must have been promiscuous. She must have been doing something naughty. So they don't want to admit it. They don't say it. And they don't know how to protect themselves because they think, I've only got one boyfriend, and he's this respectable guy. He's a clergyman or something like that, you know? So B is the wrong message, just as A and C are. The whole thing is skewed. People have a right to know the real story, and it's not that complicated either. I've explained it through interpreters to young kids who cannot read, and they get it right away. Enough.
Julie.
Hello. Thank you very much to everyone. My name is Julie Hayes, and I have the pleasure of working with our foundations in Africa. And my question has to do with following on, you were speaking about Botswana a great deal. Botswana's population has recently shifted radically. You know, it had 1 million people and now has 2 million people. 1 million of them are refugees from Zimbabwe. Uh-huh. And you're seeing that pattern throughout the neighboring countries. What are these population shifts doing? I mean, you know, what are these population shifts going to do to the epidemic or to the, you know, and what can we do, those of us that work with many of these refugees from repressive countries that are pouring into South Africa, that are pouring into Botswana, pouring into Mozambique, and what is the responsibility of those host countries towards those refugees? And, you know, usually they're thrown on a bus back, but some people during the Murambashima operation in Zimbabwe felt as though since the health system in Zimbabwe is completely collapsed, that there would be new strains that would start to come. And as people moved across the borders, that new strains, scientifically, I wouldn't have that understanding. So I wanted to know your thoughts on that and on the larger population shifts going on right now in the epicenter.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I mean, I think in terms of new strains, I think the strains they have are bad enough. I don't.
No.
But I don't think there's that much risk of that kind of thing happening. And I actually think the people of Zimbabwe, those refugees, are probably more at risk from the people in Botswana in some ways because HIV rates are actually falling in Zimbabwe than the other way around. And it's often the relatively wealthy who are the most at risk and are the most risky to others. So in terms of but those, you know, a lot of those people are young, they need education, and, you know, prostitution is still a risk. I didn't mean to say that that doesn't exist in these places, and a lot of these people may have to resort to that kind of thing. And it's a terrible, terrible problem in so many respects, and HIV is just one of them, but yeah, it's a big deal.
Hi, Sue Simon with the Sexual Health and Rights Project here at OSI. The three of you all mentioned different ideas about factors that might be related to causality, what's making spikes in epidemics, concurrency, poverty, different issues came up. I'm just wondering, Helen, in particular, if you've seen any studies about how human rights abuses are correlated with high rates of HIV, changes in the epidemic spikes. And I think one thing that we all know is that people that are pushed underground, such as sex workers or men who have sex with men and don't have access to healthcare systems, are often most at risk. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the concept of risk environment and how this relates to your research and what you've found, and how one might use research for policy change.
Yeah. In terms of pushing high-risk groups underground and that exacerbating the epidemic, I think that is a huge problem, and getting access to healthcare services for people, men who have sex with men, sex workers, drug users, and so on, is incredibly important. In the African epidemic, what's kind of interesting is that for many, many cases, the sort of typical human rights abuses don't seem to be, where you have repression, you actually have less, and war, you generally have less HIV spread for various reasons. Because of the sort of weird upside-down nature of the epidemic, it's quite different. However, domestic violence, which has now thankfully been recognized as a real live human rights abuse, is associated with HIV spread in Africa, East and Southern Africa in particular. And I think what's interesting to me about that is that a lot of people say, well, domestic violence is a risk factor because the women are not empowered enough to talk to they're afraid to talk to their partners about condom use and so on, and negotiate about the timing of sex and so on. And I think that's part of it, but what was sort of interesting to me, and what a lot of the gender people working in Africa have been really talking about a lot lately, is that a lot of the domestic violence centers around accusations of infidelity. A guy will come back, and he'll come back, and his wife will give him a dirty look because she knows where he's been. He'll start complaining about the food to justify why he's been where he's been. And a fight will break out, she'll get beaten up, etc. Or men may be very possessive, and they'll say, as one woman in Botswana said, he used to look at my footprints to see where I'd come from in the sand and stuff. And that kind of ultra, even when there's no infidelity going on at all, when he's the unfaithful one, he may transfer and beat her up just because he sort of feels guilty about his own behavior. I mean, there's a lot of pathological stuff going on, and a lot of this is not cultural behavior that's sort of set in stone or typically African or anything. I mean, it happens anywhere, but it's particularly these transitional societies are very, very vulnerable to it. I mean, the old sort of patterns of gender relations are shifting. It's like I have a chapter called The African Earthquake, which is all about this, and it's about how gender relations have been affected by the sort of sudden onset of so-called modernity or whatever it is that's happening there, where the old typical ways of life are changing and everyone's scrounging for money and the roles of men and women are changing and men really can't handle it and women can't handle it in a lot of cases either, and a lot of fighting breaks out. So what I think is that actually this reductions in multiple partnerships and more communication between men and women could mitigate both problems, the spread of HIV, obviously because the sexual networks will be broken up, and reduce the incidence of gender violence as well. It's like a confounded relationship. Infidelity is actually causing both problems. And you even see, I talked to a police chief in Botswana, who I also quote in the book, who was saying, I was asking him about these cases of growing cases of femicide, of women being killed by their partners, and he said basically in a typical case, a guy will accuse a girl of, she'll want to break up with him, and he'll say, you've been cheating and I've been supporting you, and then he'll sort of kill her and then kill himself. And there are a growing number of cases of that in Botswana and South Africa. So,
You also, following up on Sue's question, wrote in one of your pieces about the plight of wives of minors in Mozambique, I think it was, and who are left at home for months, years on end while they're migrant worker husbands go off and work in the mines, and their HIV risk is fueled by a number of things. I mean, the lack of information that they have about their risk, the fact that they might turn to transactional sex to support the family when the husbands are away, the fact that I believe the policies of mining companies deny them the opportunity to travel with their husbands and be housed. So without being explicit about it, there is a human rights and certainly a labor rights and a women's rights story being told there, and certainly, I think one of the things that characterizes your writing, Helen, is the way in which you document human rights violations. I mean, this was the point that Arya Nair made about your being a human rights investigator. Without being explicit about it, you are in effect documenting human rights abuses against these vulnerable groups and linking that to their HIV risk. Is that something you're conscious of setting out to do, or?
Yeah, I think that's maybe not what I set out to do in that particular case, but wherever you look, I mean, you find it.
Right.
In that part
We'd
of
find
the world.
It anyway.
It's.
Hi, I'm Daniel Wolf, and I work in the harm reduction program here. And one of the things that we have found, and I think the same thing would be true in the gay men's behavior change that you described, is that to a certain extent it's common sense, but to a certain extent there are behaviors that even if people know they might lead to unhealthy outcomes, they are engaged in for a variety of reasons. I guess my question is, what is the cause of concurrency,
mm-hmm.
or what are the causes of concurrency? And then a collateral question is, are there examples of community responses of, I mean, in the same way that you described a sort of community conversation,
mm-hmm.
Are there examples of that around the issue of concurrency that are useful to look at? Thanks.
Yeah. The cause of concurrency is kind of, it's a, I guess traditionally in this part of the world, that's kind of men having multiple wives was kind of the traditional social organization. What a lot of people don't know, I think, is that in a lot of these societies, often the guy who would have, say, five wives might be quite old by the time he married the fifth, because as he got older and richer, he would marry increasingly more and younger women, in a way to sort of take care of them and ensure, maximize the fertility of the group, because they were always, you know, historically fighting against decimation because their lives are so tough on the African frontier. But the thing that a lot of people may not realize is there was kind of a sort of silence around the fact that a lot of these young women, you know, these sort of older guys couldn't necessarily keep up with all these wives. And the young women would somehow, sometimes this was sort of tacitly understood, that they would sneak around behind their husband's back and have an affair with a younger guy who might be part of a sort of warrior age band that wasn't able to or allowed to marry yet because he didn't have enough cows or something. And so there was these concurrent networks were part of the kind of traditional fabric in a lot of these societies for a very, very long time. And not universally, but they're kind of common. And they've now, you know, the sort of informalization and changes and social changes that have taken place have kind of shifted the way they're actualized, I guess, or whatever the word is. And, you know, they take on a very different form, but the same pattern and the same expectations and the shifting expectations underneath them are what this contemporary epidemic are really sort of all about. Now, what was interesting about Uganda was that there was a lot of conversing about this kind of thing, about, you know, my husband has another girlfriend, or that's why I gave that example about the co-wives and concubines. I mean, this was a special group of women who were acknowledged concubines or co-wives, and they got together and they said, we've got to do something. We've got to close the circle, the wagons around our family so that that doesn't sort of, you know, get become part of this chain. And I that was very pragmatic. And there was a lot of that going on in less formal ways. Those were the kinds of discussions that were happening. It was very similar to what happened with gays, I think.
You've been standing longer than
me. Okay. Hi, I'm Joya Banerjee from the Global Youth Coalition on HIV/AIDS. And it's such a pleasure to hear you speak in person. And I had a question for you. The Global Youth Coalition on HIV/AIDS is a network of young people doing AIDS work in 150 countries, but the majority of our members are in sub-Saharan Africa. And what I found is that many of them are very propagandized in terms of the themes behind their prevention efforts by their governments, by bilateral donors, by the church, et cetera, in terms of abstinence only, or parroting what they hope will bring them funding or what they think the donors really want to hear. And our work is really to bridge the divide between what's going on in this room at the UN. I also used to work at UNFPA with Wesley, so I understand his question very well. Hello. So the UN is right now trying to enact what they call a paradigm shift in the way that the world thinks about HIV/AIDS, but I'm not convinced that we have laid the groundwork for that to happen. So I guess I'd like to hear what your opinion is in terms of how we can really improve the system and create a way that will bring this paradigm shift not from the UN or not from governments or donors, but rather from the people themselves.
Gee.
Big question, sorry.
I wish. It's a little bit, the book is sort of my two cents. I mean, I wrote it so that everyone could read it and get to, sort of think about things differently from the way that they have been told to think about it. So beyond that, I have no idea how to do that. I mean, I completely sympathize. I didn't know that a paradigm shift was underway. But if you could tell me more about it either now or later, I'd love to know.
It's a campaign that's kind of in thinking right now, and it's going to take several years, I'm sure. But it's called AIDS 2031, and the idea is that in 25 years, it will be 50 years since AIDS was discovered, and that we're not doing things in the right way, and the money isn't getting to the people that it needs to get to. So it's, it's definitely in its trial stages right now, but I think that it needs a new way about going about things rather than having the traditional UN-type campaign, and whether it be ideas of academics or people working at the grassroots or the donors themselves, I'm not sure, but clearly what we're doing right now isn't really working.
Yeah. That's interesting. And 2031 is being led by the UN AIDS program? Or
It's being engendered by UN AIDS, but the lead is being taken by other partners.
Well, whose fault is it that put in this?
I guess we should talk later.
I don't know. They tend to talk a lot about participation and groups like you and your voices being heard. And that, I mean, every single speech that Peter Piot gives contains those kinds of sentiments.
Right.
So do you get the feeling that they listen to you or not? I mean, if you don't, then maybe be directly critical of them. Maybe that's what I don't hear enough from grassroots groups is enough actual criticism of the way things are getting done. I mean, you see it a little bit more, a few more sort of journalists going out and questioning things like,
right.
Is Millennium Villages the right way to go necessarily, mm-hmm. for example, or...
Is Millennium Villages the
what?
Right way to go?
What'd you say?
Is Millennium Villages the right way to
I'm
go?
I'm not going
to
go there. But I think, sort of use what you guys know, get information from the ground and raise questions about this and make a lot of noise about it. If you're in a position to do that, if you're in an organization and stuff, and you can, there's a foundation here that's going to help you.
I see you, Lila. I just want to make an announcement since I see some people leaving that books are available for sale. Sharon, is it Sharon at the back, is selling books by the door there. So please take advantage of that. Lila.
Hi, I'm Lila Elman from the Public Health Program here at OSI, and Helen, thank you so much for being here and writing your book. I found it really eye-opening and informative. But just to sort of add a note of skepticism or probe your mind for more information about the research on long-term concurrency, when you wrote the chapter about Martina Morris's study, you said that she devised a new method for taking sexual histories that elicited the reports of long-term concurrency. And I wondered if that methodology had been used in the United States and other Western countries, because when I was reading it, it didn't sound necessarily so different than practices amongst my friends, particularly in college or in their early 20s. Someone won't identify themselves as being with a person anymore, but when they break up, they don't actually split. You may continue to sleep with that person off and on for months, 4 years. You may have 3 or 4 partners that, like, whenever they're in town or you were at the same party, you end up sleeping with them. So I started wondering, is the West really, how serial monogamist are we in terms of as much as we claim to be? Or what if we are less long-term concurrent than Africans, how long is long term, or how short do the spaces have to be between relationships?
Yeah, yeah.
Or is that we've been so inundated with condom use that condom use even in long term relationships is more common here?
No, I don't think so. It's very uncommon even here, long term relationships. And in fact, even among gay men, consistent condom use, meaning every single time in long term relationships, is pretty rare. I mean, people practice In Australia, they call it negotiated safety, where you use condoms with when you go outside, but not with your long-term partner. But in terms of long-term concurrency, I did oversimplify. I mean, the point is the length of the overlap. Mm-hmm. And if you actually look at what Martina Morris did, I mean, that was what she found, is the overlaps were longer in the African sites and so on. And the question that Michelle Carell asked was, you know, in addition to your regular partner, do you have another partner that's lasted more than a year? So these were overlapping for quite a substantial amount of time. And the other thing is that while there is quite a bit of long-term concurrency in, you know, sort of the younger groups here, for one thing, the long-term concurrency is sort of less distributed throughout life. So people mm-hmm. may practice it in college, high school. This is my recollection anyway from a long time ago. And, you know, kind of in their early 20s, but then settle down into this pattern of sort of searching for the one true love and one after another after that. And that's an oversimplification, but it does seem to be what the surveys have found. And there have been some pretty detailed sexual surveys of sexual behavior in the U.S., finding that as well, by and large. And the communities that have more long-term concurrency tend to have higher HIV rates.
So the difference is mostly that it's for a year or longer and that it continues past
your
20s?
Well, it's more long-term. It's more, the overlap is longer, and that the period through life during which long-term concurrency is practiced is longer. So in other words, people, you know, kind of, in our culture, my personal view, understanding of it is that in sort of heterosexual culture here, people do that in high school, college, and so on. But there's also a tendency to kind of agonize about it. It's not the norm. It's like, ooh, who do I end up with, and what do I do?
Depends on your friends.
It's more torture for the person who's actually in the midst of these relationships than it is for the people actually being cheated on. Or it's bad, and everyone is tearing their hair out, and then people do settle down in their 20s into this serial pattern. Whereas in Africa, I'm generalizing like mad here because there's mm-hmm. There's whole different. But I do that so as not to speak forever. But that there is, it's often the older a man gets, the more likely he is to have multiple concurrent partnerships. Mm. And so you have this sort of distribution, a longer period throughout life during which this is being practiced, and that increases the fraction of overlapping relationships in the whole population, and the typical, the age gaps, which also people have identified as a big driver in the epidemic and stuff. I mean, this is partly causing that, too, because the young women that are being slept with may not be having concurrent partnerships, but their partners are, so. And your partner's behavior is actually a bigger risk factor, paradoxically, than your own, according to epidemiological surveys. That's what's really interesting, also, is that it's what your partner's doing. You have to, in these surveys, to measure the risk of having concurrent partnerships, you have to measure what the person's partner is doing. That's another reason why it hasn't really been studied much, because it's so hard to measure that. People never know. So.
My name is Catherine Buffalino, and I work with the African Services Committee. We do HIV prevention in the African community here in New York. And I just wanted to ask you to follow up on the question about community conversations about concurrency, how you'd like to see this information taken to the grassroots level in African communities, how we can start to communicate effectively around some of these issues, and also what tools may be available, even if it's only those kind of PowerPoint slides that showed so visually the way that this works. And also, I wanted to ask about Stuart Parkinson's video.
You mean this cartoon?
That you mentioned.
Yeah, well, that was the one I showed. That was just the cartoon that I showed.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, if you want a copy of that, write me an email and I'll send it to you. It's, and show it to everyone uptown, actually. But I think, I don't know, I was talking to a guy who is the HIV advisor for East and Southern Africa for UNICEF recently, actually, and he was talking about trying to incorporate some of this information into, I don't know why they've sort of given up on these school-based education programs, but I hope that they would do it in those too, but in little newspapers or cartoon books for kids or little games that kids can play and things like that and teach it to people that way. And the most important thing is that it be done in a kind of morally neutral way. You know, that's the most important thing. It's not that these are bad people who do this or good people, whatever. But that
it's
Well, not if you explain it this way. You know, if science is always good for, that's what science is for, actually, is for taking away that kind of moral judgment element and biases and prejudices. That's the whole point of it. So, yeah. Anyway, any further questions?
Great. Sure. Why don't we take one last question, and then we'll use the last 10 minutes for the reception of which you were deprived at the beginning.
This is kind of a follow-up to the one that was asked over there and another kind of devil's advocate question, which is just assuming that reduction in concurrent partnerships is behind the drop in prevalence or incidence in Uganda, in theory, you should be able to document that there was indeed less concurrent partnerships. Has anyone either tried to do that or succeeded in doing
that? Yeah. I mean, there's a read chapter 10 in my book. and I have a couple of, I had a couple of slides I didn't show you, but that was what people, there's tons of evidence that that's what happened. And it wasn't just reductions in concurrent partnerships, because people were having casual partnerships too, as they do everywhere. But there, the casual partnerships are much more dangerous, because you don't just infect one person, you infect, like, tons. So people also reduce their casual partners as well as their concurrent partners, I think. As far as we know, that wasn't so well measured. They measured reductions in casual partners, but for some reason, even though the guy who made that picture that showed the dramatic preponderance of these multiple concurrent partnerships in Africa worked for UNAIDS, the UNAIDS program that designed the studies that measured sexual behavior throughout the 1990s did not incorporate that question in their surveys. I don't know why. It was almost like there was almost a deliberate blackout. And the questions that they did ask were kind of insane. It was like, you know, not even do you have multiple partnerships, but do you have a partner who is non-spousal, non-cohabitating? I mean, it was so confusing. I couldn't answer those questions. And so a lot of the, it's very hard to get good information on this, but we do know that in Uganda there was a steep decline in casual partnerships. We know less about what happened with concurrent partnerships, but anecdotally there was a decline. So, yeah.
Well, Helen, thank you so much. I have to say, for myself watching the Parkinson video, the emotion that I felt was sort of a sense of fear. I mean, it's so scary to watch that spread, and you've written in the past about how fear can actually be used strategically in HIV prevention, but as long as it's not fear of other people or of marginalized people, but fear of getting sick, and there's a tactical way in which that can be used and in which communities have used it, although internationally I think we've largely ignored that. So thank you very much for being so generous with your time and your ideas, and on behalf of all of us in the public health program at OSI and our friends in New York, come again, and thank you so much.
Good.